thing is, look, there are times, you know, when chopping wood is actually, it's not a voluntary action, but it is a mitzvah, right? So, are we to assume that if somebody is engaged in a mitzvah, just as we said before at the end of the Mishnah, right, that, let's say he is the father, you know, who's chastising his son, okay? That's a mitzvah, and therefore the Torah, you know, the Torah, you say, would exempt him. Well, let's say the sages exempt him, okay? So, are we to say then that if a person is engaged in chopping wood for a mitzvah, as for building a sukkah, or to bring firewood in order to the Beis HaMikdash, so then he should be exempt, right? But the question is, v'afilo hachi, but even under these circumstances, suggests, you know, this person who asked Rava, he says, Omer Achbono Ligle, the Torah says that he has to go into Golas, even if he were performing a mitzvah with his chopping wood, he has to go into Golas. So of course that would raise the following question, then how could you say that the father who's chastising his son should be excused from going into Golas if he inadvertently kills his son, right? Or the rabbi, his student, and so on and so forth. So Omalei, so what did Rava answer him? So Rava said to him, I'll tell you. He says, Kevin di mutza chotub lav mitzvah. It says, inasmuch as, if, let's say, he already found wood which had been chopped, then in that case, there is no question that it's not a mitzvah. In other words, the chopping wood afterwards, you know, would not be a mitzvah because he already has wood that he could use either for his sukkah or to bring to the Beis HaMikdash as a donation, right? Yeah. So, hashto nami lav mitzvah. So, maybe it was to say that over here too, namely in the case of, let's say, the father, the Rebbe, right? There is no mitzvah that's involved, and therefore, the person deserves to go into Golas as his punishment. That's what he's asking him. Eispei Rabin Levova. So Ravina now asks the following question of Rav. He says, look, it says, Yotza ho'ov ha'makez b'no, right? V'harav ha'vod is talmidu shlich bezdin. So, the Mishnah that we've just quoted, that the father who strikes his son, the teacher who strikes his, or who chastises his student, and the Shliach Bezdin, who is, performing the act of Malchus upon the miscreant, big word, right? Yeah. So, the Mishnah says that they are exempted from going. So, Lemo, are we to say then, Kevan, the Ilu Gomir, Lav Mitzvah, Hashtonami, Lav Mitzvah. So now we say, so he's asked the following question. He says, are we to say that? Look, if, why does the Rebbe have the permission, shall we say, to strike his student? Because he wants to get him to learn his lesson, okay? So therefore he has a certain right. Now, what happens, however, if the student has learned well? So, is there a mitzvah then that the teacher should strike him, right? Sure. So it's lav mitzvah, right? So hashtonami lav mitzvah. So now too, namely that if we find that let's say the wood is already chopped, he finds chopped wood already. So we would say then that there's no mitzvah to go and do what? To go and to chop further wood, right? There's no mitzvah. So they say Hosam there, in other words, in the case of the Talmud, right? Or it doesn't have to be the Talmud, it could even be the son, because the son too has to learn a lesson, alright?
Right.
So we say Apalgav de Gomir, even though the son has learned, namely he's learned that he knows that he's supposed to behave himself and he's aware of that. But nevertheless, mitzvah, there is still an element of mitzvah that's involved in it. The sieve, As the pasuk says, it's a verse taken from Proverbs, it says, Yaser bincho, chastise your son, binichecha, and he will put you at ease, or he will give you rest. In other words, he will feel, you know, confident because of the fact that your son has learned from your chastising him, you know, how to behave himself. And what will be the result? The result will be, and he will give you great satisfaction, literally. He will give you enjoyment to yourself. In other words, Hashem, a lot of nachas from him, because having learned his lesson, he'll behave himself. So therefore, there is a mitzvah that's involved in it, right? So, to sum up at the moment, there is a mitzvah as far as chastisement is concerned. But is there a mitzvah as far as going into chop wood when you already can find wood that's already been prepared? So, Hodor Omar Rava. So then Rava said, you know what? He says, Lav Milsahi Da'amri. Says, I've changed my mind about what I've said. I'd like to say something else. Okay? In other words, I would like to derive what I have to say from a different situation rather than the one that I've quoted to you before. It says, the Torah, the same, you know, section which deals with the person, you know, has to go into Golos because of the killing the person, you know, in the forest, right, while chopping wood. It's written over there, V'asher Yevo Esrehu Bayar, right? And in the case of somebody who comes together with his fellow man into the forest, so it says, Ma Yar, just as in the case of the forest, what? The Iboy Ayil, the Iboy Lo Ayil, if he feels like it, he can go into the forest, right? And if he doesn't feel like it, so he doesn't go into the forest, right? The Yisal Kodatech Mitzvah. And if you think that this is a mitzvah to go into the forest, Misaga de lo ayil, is this any greater than not to go? After all, who says that you have to go into the forest in order to chop wood if you already have the wood? So Amalei Rav Oda Barava de Rava. So Barava said to Rava, he says, look, Kol Heichod Yichsiv Asher, says, wherever we find the word Asher written, then the Iboyhu, right? Then what does it imply? It implies that if he feels like it, in other words, if it says Ba'asher, then in that particular case, it means that it's up to the person. If he feels like it, okay. If he doesn't feel like it, also all right. Something like that. Voluntary, right? In other words, what? Asher does not imply that it is a mitzvah, that it's a commandment, you know, that he must do that. This is what he says to him. So, they question that now, because obviously, we have psukim where the word asher is used in connection. Well, it's clearly a mitzvah, right? And they quote one. Ela meyato, this is the case, he says. How about this pasuk? Ve'ish asher yitmor ve'lo yischato. This is taken from the section in the Torah where we deal with the law of the Pora Aduva, right?
Red heifer.
Sin, Pasha Chukas.
The red heifer.
The red heifer, right. Yeah. Right. You remember the story over there is, you know, that they take it and they have to burn it, right? And then they use the ashes, they mix it with Mayim Chayim and so on.
Right.
And they use it in order to sprinkle on people who have become Tomei. Right. Become Tomei. And it has to be done on the third day, on the seventh day, right? Ayim HaShlishi, Ayim HaShvi, and so on and so forth. Now, question is as follows. The word asher is also over there because it's written, the ish, a person, asher yidmo, right?
Yeah.
Who will become tame, velo yisato, and he will not, lo yisato means he will not be cleansed from his, in other words, he won't be, purified from his tumor, you know, by means, of course, of the sprinkling of the Yefer HaPora, right?
Yeah.
So, are we to say then that Iboy Mitmo, Iboy Le Mitmo, right? If he feels like it, he can defile himself, and if he feels like it, he won't defile himself. Can you say that? It's written specifically that if a person has become tame and has not yet cleansed himself, right, the lay is chato, then what's written? If he happens to come, let's say, into the Mikdash HaDeshem, right?
Yeah.
So it's written, V'nichraso ha-nefesh ha-hi,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That soul will be cut off. In other words, the punishment of what they call kores, right?
Right.
Kimei nido lo'izorak alov, because the waters of purification have not been sprinkled upon him, right?
Yeah.
So, tome yiyye,
he
is still tome, right? Oy tumosago, and his tumor still remains within him. This is what the Pasuk says over there. And of course, when a person comes and he says, you know, it's Mikdash Hashem Timei, right? And so you realize then that this is liable to the punishment of Koresh. Well, in that case, how can you say that if he feels like it, he can feel that he's Tomei, and if he feels like it, he decides that he's not Tomei? Obviously, if he comes in a state of tumor into the Beis HaMikdash or into the Ohel Moed, you know, wherever it may be, then in that particular case, he is guilty. Right, and he deserves the punishment of Koresh.
So what does Koresh mean? What does that mean?
Koresh means, literally, it means that his soul will be cut off from his people, okay? Which is considered a very, very severe punishment. It ranks below death as, you know, as far as severity of punishment is concerned. Many interpret Koresh as being a punishment that involves that a person dies earlier than he's supposed to. This is one interpretation of what Koresh involves. And of course, we have quite a few sins mentioned in the Torah where Koresh is the punishment. We had, for example, in most of the arroyos, in other words, the prohibited relationships, you know, a person can't marry, or if you wish, have intercourse, you know, with a mother, with an aunt, and things like that, and so on, right, with a sister, and so on. So, Koresh is a punishment for many of these things. And then we have Koresh mentioned. There are two, normally it's for violation of a negative commandment.
That shall not.
Right. But there are two commandments in the Torah where Koresh is mentioned for the violation of an affirmative one. Right. One of them is Bila.
Yeah.
The person, right, you know, circumcision. If a person refused, you know, to have his son circumcised, then in that case he is guilty and he deserves Koresh for that.
Yeah.
And the other case is Chometz on Pesach. But if you eat Chometz on Pesach, then it's also written over there, V'nichus ha'nev shehi Yisrael. So, those are some of the cases.
It's an important piece of it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, needless to say, it's very important that you don't eat Chometz on Pesach.
If
only people would...
The people don't observe that.
...would realize the severity, you know, and how we look upon it, you see. Yeah. All right. So obviously then we have to say that in that particular case, there is no asher, meaning that if you feel like it, okay, and if you don't feel like it, also.
It's a literal translation of asher.
Asher, which or who, that which or something like that.
Where does it imply that it's an option?
This is a good question.
I mean,
this is his drash.
He states it that way.
This is his drash, exactly. But on the other hand, if you take a look, there's a Tosfos that says that they don't buy it. Top of the next page is a Tosfos, very small. Take a look at it for a second. You see, Tome Yeh Mikol Mokim, sort of run ahead slightly.
Yeah, see.
But it says, Koshelish take.
Oh, yeah, at the top.
Right.
Yeah.
He says, I find it hard to be silent in this case. In other words, the Tosfos himself is protesting against it because he says, May Asher, may the Yiyah. In other words, when you have words like Asher and Yiyah and so on, why do I find it difficult? Because he says, V'yesh Lomar, because in the final analysis, the Asher, Urche de Krohu. The word Asher, this is a normal expression that we find in the Torah. So, you know, to try to get a kvetch out of it is forcing the issue of it.
It's a long shot.
Right. So, Tosfos was not happy with this drash. Okay. But inasmuch as, you know, Rav Ada Barahava feels, you know, that he suggests that Rava feels that Asher implies, you know, yes, if I feel like it, and no, if I don't feel like it. And he's saying, what do you mean? Every place where it's written Asher, you mean that that is the case, you know, that you have a choice? There's no choice over there, because it says, right, the Yisha Sheit Mogla is Chata, right? You cannot say Iboi Mitmo, Iboi Le Mitmo. So where do we consider it a mitzvah that a person has to voluntarily become tummy? I mean, normally we would say a person becomes tummy, why? Inadvertently. Wasn't careful, whatever it was. Let's say, for example, that he entered a place where there was a corpse. Okay?
He didn't know.
He didn't realize that. Sure. Okay? So in that particular case, he becomes tummy. I mean, we are aware of the fact that the Kohen is Muskar al-Tumah, right? The Kohen is commanded, you know, not to defile himself. But that's because he's a Kohen. How about an ordinary Israelite? An ordinary Israelite, or a Levi even, I mean, can defile himself, but he cannot come into the Beis HaMikdosh in the state of Tumah. In order to come into the Beis HaMikdosh, you have to be in the state of Tahara. And how can you achieve Tahara? So, you know, it's by being sprinkled with the water which was mixed with the ashes of the Paraduma, you see. The Mechatos, okay? And that's one of the reasons why, you know, they say that today nobody is free from Tumah. Yeah. Everybody has Tumah to a certain degree because we don't have this water of purification.
We don't have it.
Right. All right. But there is a case where it's absolutely commanded. Where is the case? He says Meis Mitzvah. Right? What is a Meis Mitzvah? Meis Mitzvah is a case where you suddenly come across
a corpse.
Okay? So, it's a mitzvah to bury the corpse. You have to bury. And the Talmud says, you know, that even a Kohen Gadol, you know, I said before that a Kohen is Muskar al-Tumah, he has to be careful, you know, not to defile himself. But nevertheless, the Torah itself specified that there are certain relationships where the Kohen must be Metami. It's a mitzvah for the Kohen to be Metami, namely, for his father, for his mother, right?
That's right, yeah. Media family.
Brother, sister, son, daughter, and so on. Wife, obviously, right? So the Kohen has a mitzvah, you see, to be Metami. Okay, but how about the Kohen Gadol? He's never permitted to be Metami, even for his father or for his mother. Gemara in Sanhedrin describes, you know, what happens. I mean, he loses his father, let's say he loses his mother. Says min hamikdash liyetsay, he's not allowed to leave literally the mikdash, right, the holy place. Which in the Gemara they say it doesn't mean that, you know, he's not allowed to get outside of the Beis HaMikdash, but what it does mean is he's never allowed to go out of his state of being kodesh, as being, you know, in the state of purity, really, being holy. Okay, yeah. But even the Kohen Gadol, if he should happen to be and he sees a Meis Mitzvah, then in that particular case, he has the same
obligation
to defile himself, you know, to the Meis Mitzvah, because this is considered, you know, the highest form of the Chesed Shalemus that we could perform.
Rabbi, isn't it true that if you come across a dead animal, you're supposed to bury it or put it in a
Well, it's a nice thing, but we're not required to do that. That's not a requirement, okay? I mean, you're being humane if you do something like that. But,
Doesn't say anything about it? Doesn't it mention?
No. It doesn't say that you have a mitzvah to go and to bury it, okay?
But it is brought up somewhere. I think
that
came across somewhere.
Look, it's an act of humanity, if you wish. You're being humane if you do something like that, okay? But look at all the animals, I mean, that you find on the road and so on, right? I mean, they...
So you pick them up and put them on the side?
Yeah, well, you want to stop when you're doing 65, 70 miles an hour in order to do it. Got to be awfully careful about that. Okay. Call the SPCA. All right. So it says, Meis Mitzvah. The Le Sagli Mitami. In the case of Meis Mitzvah, you can't help but being mitami. You have to do it. You have to be willing to defile yourself in order to perform the mitzvah. Sure. So we say, Hochinami the potter, right? Are we to say that in case he buried a Meis Mitzvah, then in that particular case, are we to say that, he's free from the punishment of Kores, namely as a result of his defilement, right? If he goes into the Beis HaMikdash subsequently without purifying himself, are we to say that if he goes into the Beis HaMikdash, he hasn't been purified, but why? Because he performed the mitzvah. So are we to say then that he would be free from Kores? They say nothing doing. Mm. He still would get Kores because his obligation is to purify himself before going into the Beis HaMikdash, and can't claim on the basis I just finished a mitzvah, just finished performing a mitzvah, therefore I don't have to be. Exactly. They say, Shani Hosam, that case is different. Why do you my Kror? Because the Pasuk says, Tomei Yiyah, right? He is to be Tomei, which means Mekol Mokom.
In any place.
Under any circumstance. In other words, he's not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash while he's in the state of
that's another
impurity.
Abbreviation
Mekol Mokom, right? In any case, that's what it means, Mekol Mokom. Alright, so Hahumi Boile, so now they raise a different objection. They say, look, Tome Yiyah, he says, I already learned it through a different teaching. Don't we need it, he says, for the Tanya, as we have learned in this Gemara in Nozir, where it says Tomeiya means the Rabbos Tevul Yom, that includes the Tevul Yom, I'll explain them in a second, and to Mosei Bay, the rest of that Pasuk, because, you know, his tumor remains within him, this the Rabbos Mechus Kippurim, that includes these. Alright. So this, they derive from Tomeiya, right, to Mosei Bay. Now, what is the Tevul Yom? This goes back to something that we learned right at the beginning of Brachas. Remember, right on the very first page over there, you know, they ask the following question, you know, the Mosai Kohen Shema Bahar, right? Yeah. From what point on do you have to read the Shema at night? In other words, you know, what is the earliest time that you could do it? Yeah. And they gave an answer that was rather, very strange. They didn't say from sunset on, but what did they say? Say Mishosha Kohanim Nichtasin Lechol B'Trumasa, right? From the time when Kohanim are permitted to go into the Beis HaMikdash and eat Truma. So at that time we explained, what does it have to do with Kohanim? So the answer is that if a person inadvertently becomes Tomei, not through contact with the dead, but let's say he has a seminal emission, okay? Mm-hmm. Alright, so in that particular case, what is the procedure before he's permitted to eat Truma as a Kohen, or before he would be permitted to go back to go into the Beis HaMikdash, or let's say if a person goes to the Beis HaMikdash and he wants to bring a sacrifice which he is permitted to eat part of, you know, like shlomim, todo, and things like that. So the answer is, he has to first immerse himself in a mikveh while it's still daytime, but he still is not allowed to do it until after sunset. Why? Because the Torah says, Uvo HaShemesh, when the sun sets, then the Toher, then he becomes purified. Okay? So this is a Tevul Yom. Person who has already immersed himself in the mikveh during the day, but still he has not yet achieved the full
state of
purification, right? Because he has to wait until sunset. Okay. So the prohibition then is derived from Tomei Yiyah, and then to Mosavo, this refers to the Mechusa Kippur. Mechusa Kippur means that in the Torah there are certain cases where it says that if a person becomes defiled, as for example in the case of the Zov and the Zova, okay? The Zov and the Zova, it's a male or a female who has what today they consider like a flow of gonorrhea or something like that, yeah. Okay? The flow, you know, you
an
see
infection.
That, right. There's an infection, and let's say in the case of a man, you know, you see that there's an infection, you know, there's like whatever it may be, pus or something like that coming out of the penis, and, you know, it has nothing to do with intercourse or anything like that. It's obviously it's not. Or in the case of a woman, where she has an issue, and it's not related at all to her cycle, you see, it's independent of her cycle, yeah. And so on. So if it has a recurrence of that, then automatically they are prohibited, you know, they become unclean. And then how do they become clean again? So obviously after, you know, the
flow stops.
After the flow has stopped, they have to count 7 days. And then, you know, they have to immerse themselves. And then, after that, they still have to bring also a korban. They have to bring a korban, okay? So, if they have not yet brought the korban, then they are, at this particular point, mechusa or kippurim. In other words, they have not yet achieved the full state of atonement, so to speak, because they have not yet brought the the korban that they have to bring.
Mechusa means a lack of kippurim.
Right. In other words, they are lacking the final state of Kippurim, of atonement, you know, for their uncleanliness, because they have not yet brought the sacrifice. Another case would be, for example, Yoledes, a woman who was given birth, in, you know, in the time that the Beis HaMikdash was in existence. So the woman, of course, had to count a certain prescribed number of days.
Depending on whether it's male
right,
or female.
Whether it was 33, 66, and so on and so forth. Whether it's 1 week, 2 weeks, and so on, okay? So then afterwards, she had to come to the Beis HaMikdash. And what did she bring? She would bring some birds, like doves, and so on and so forth. All right, so, you know, these would be sacrificed. And so if she hadn't brought it, then she could not yet come to the Beis HaMikdash. And it was considered a mitzvah to come to the Beis HaMikdash so that the woman could give thanksgiving to God, you know, for having survived the childbirth and, you know, having the joy of having a child to rear. So that's an act of which, you know, which would require, so to speak, an act of thanksgiving on her part to bring it. So, as long as she hasn't brought it yet, then she's b'chuser kippurim. All right. So, getting back to the text over here, so we said, look, we needed those words, Tomei Yiyah, right? And Tumosei Boy says, I needed those in order to teach those lessons. So Amalei, so he says, so he answered him. He says, Ano me'od kamina. The word that I'm stressing, the fact that he still is Tomei, this is from the word od, which, you know, we might say, you know, that the word is not necessary, right? So, since the word od is not necessary, it simply could have said to Mosabo, didn't have to say od to Mosabo. So the fact that it says still, so this is because in order to teach us that Tomei Yiyah is Mikol Mokum, as we said, that even if he had performed, you know, the act of burying the Mace Mitzvah, but nevertheless, he still is not allowed to come into the Beis HaMikdash without having cleansed himself beforehand, because the tumba still remains with him. Ikar d'masne, there are those who learned that the discussion was Ikar d'masne lo, who learned ahor in connections with the different case. Torah says Bechorish v'akotzir tishbos, which normally refers to Shabbos. In other words, it says that you have to tishbos, in other words, you have to observe Shabbos, if you wish, whether it is in plowing or in reaping, right?
Yeah.
However,
in other words, all kinds of work on Shabbos.
Right. I mean, this pasuk is quoted in order to teach us, you know, that there are certain things that we call, you know, malachas on Shabbos, okay? In other words, categories of labor which are prohibited on Shabbos. And therefore, this verse is cited as proof of that. However, the Chachamim, when it came to the Mishnah, they said that there's another implication in this verse. Because they say the fact, you know, that you're not allowed to do work on Shabbos, this already we find plenty of other places. We don't have to have this specifically mentioned. The Chavish Rakotiyah. So that therefore, they apply it to the idea of Shviyas. In other words, the seventh year. That where do you have to do? You have to observe it, right, as far as Chavish and Kotzir. In other words, you're not allowed to plow, right? And you're not allowed to reap in the seventh year. Okay?
Of course, the year reaping, of rest. The year of rest.
This is a year, right, when the earth has to have its rest. Okay? So, Rabbi Akiva is not happy with that. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Rabbi Akiva says, Einu tzorich tzorich. He says, I don't have to apply the verse, Bechvish HaKotzir, you know, Shel Shviyas. The Kotzir Shel Shviyas. I don't have to apply to the Chorish Shel Shviyas of plowing in the seventh year, or the Kotzir Shel Shviyas, or, you know, reaping. The reaping in the seventh year. Sharek for Nehemar, because we already have another pasuk which mentions specifically things that you're not allowed to do in the seventh year. Namely, it's written, you know, in Parsha Behar, Sefer Vayikra, over there where they mention the laws of Shviyas. Sharek for Nehemar, over there it's already said that Sotcho lo Sizra, you're not allowed to seed your field, right? The chamechod or sismar, nor are you allowed to prune your vineyard. Okay. So, in that particular case, since we already have psukim that tell us you're not allowed to do this in Shviyas, so what are we adding by bechuvish v'akotzer? You understand? According to Rabbi Akiva, so he says, Ela atilu chorish shel erev Shviyas shenichnas l'Shviyas. The kotzer shel shviyas sheyotzer the moitzoy shviyas, but rather this also includes another prohibited period. Namely, you're not allowed just prior to the beginning of the seventh year to do plowing, nor are you permitted to do harvesting at that time. This is what he is. I mean, that doesn't mean that the law actually follows Rabbi Akiva, but this is how he interprets it. Okay. I'll come back to that in a second. And also it applies, he says, to the time immediately following Shviyas. You're not allowed to do it immediately after. Okay. All right. So getting back to what he's saying over here, this requires really a little bit more elucidation. Okay. We have the laws of Shviyas are complicated. They're complicated because it's not only the prohibition during that particular year, but you have a question about how long does it take, for example, for something planted to yield fruit or something like that. You understand? So if, for example, you know that it's going to take a long time, so there's one rule. If it takes only a short time, there's a different rule. Okay? So without going into all the complexities, and believe me, it's a very complex subject, but we have in general, for example, a prohibition that for a month prior to Rosh Hashanah, we stop agricultural work, okay? So this is what he means by the plowing of the, you know,
the land,
you know, prior to the time when Shviyas itself begins, okay? Likewise, things, for example, that grew during Shviyas, during the seventh year, you're not allowed to automatically begin harvesting them afterwards either. You would have to wait until you've had a chance to plant new stuff and so on and so forth and so on. So that, you know, it doesn't automatically behave. It's complex. This is why in Eretz Yisrael, where the laws of Shvi'is are in effect, you have to have people who really are experts in this particular field. The average person, for example, who would take a look at the Mishnah, Seder Zeroyim, and you come, I mean, to something like that, you have all kinds of technical terms for different plants and things like that and so on, which in the time in the Mishnah, you know, they knew this subject very, very well. And in Eretz Yisrael, as found in the Gemara Yerushalmi, in the Talmud Yerushalmi, they still had a practical knowledge of, you know, the various types, the terms that you use for this plant, that plant, the other plant, etc., etc. But for those of us who have been so far removed from the agriculture of Eretz Yisrael, it's really, it requires a great deal relearning or new learning or whatever it may be in order to even familiarize ourselves with some of the highlights.
So they're very good in botany then, huh?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Yeah, excellent climate.
You have to remember, I mean, that what?
Pliny.
You mean Pliny? Oh, I suppose I'm Pliny. Yeah, Pliny was a Roman who, among other things, he wrote about nature, planting like that. Yeah. Yeah, but this was common knowledge at the time because of the fact that Jews were primarily an agricultural people. Sure. 2,000 years ago. They lived in Eretz Yisrael. They were an agricultural people. Of course, another problem that we have is simply the fact that most of us are not living in Eretz Yisrael. And, you know, if we don't live in Eretz Yisrael, we are obliged to observe the Shvi'is of Eretz Yisrael in the sense that if this is a product that comes from Eretz Yisrael, if it was grown or harvested, let's say, during the seventh year, we're not allowed to use it. And that's why, for example, on canned goods, if they are sold and, you know, they're really under an excellent hashgacha, you'll see on it, written in Hebrew, I only wish it were written in English as well, but they'll tell you, for example, that it's noki, the chashash. This product, you know, is absolutely clear of any even hint of what? Of tevel, orlo, shvius. Okay? What is tevel? Tevel means that, you know, the trumas of maishpas were not taken from it. In other words, in Eretz Yisrael, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you see that, you know, the balabostas, they'll take, let's say, the fruit, and they'll take a certain fruit and they'll discard it from the heap. You don't put it in the garbage either. It has to be either left for the animals to eat or something like that, okay? Because you're not allowed to take something which is in itself, it has a like a trace of holiness, you see, and destroy it. Yeah. But you have to separate a certain amount. So this is a very important part, that you separate trumas and maishvas, that's tevel. Or law, this is a law which applies both in Eretz Yisrael and outside of Eretz Yisrael, namely, that the first 3 years that a tree has been planted, and if it produces fruit, that fruit cannot be eaten, okay? It can only be eaten the fourth year. Or if we're living outside of Eretz Yisrael, it would be the fifth year.
So what happens to the fruit? Is it just discarded?
You have to discard it, right? You leave it in the field, right? You leave it for the animals to consume. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing, as I said, tevel, truma, tevel, and the shvius, right? Namely that this was not either harvested in the seventh year or planted in the seventh year and so on. So these are things that we have to observe. But naturally, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, it's much hotter over there. Mm-hmm. They have to rely upon, for example, let's say, fruits and vegetables that come to them, you know, from foreign countries or something like that. Naturally, if you pick it. Yeah, it has to be imported. You know, anything that grows in the year just prior, in the sixth year, up to close to the time that I said, you know, when you're not allowed to do any more agricultural labor, but anything up to that particular point can be stored, of course, and then used when you have to. So that's not such a major problem, but as the time goes on, you run out of it, so you have to import. Or they buy from the Arabs. But today, to buy from the Arabs is already more of a problem because of the fact that once upon a time you had your friends with the Arabs, you know, coming around in order to sell you all kinds of things. Today, Jews are a little bit afraid to do business with your friendly Arabs because they're no longer friendly.
Either. You don't know where they got them from either. But let me ask a question about that. Yeah. What if a farmer has several fields?
Yeah.
Sharia comes around, he leaves one field open, or, I mean, he's staggering the planting of his fields.
It won't work. It won't work for the simple reason that Sharia applies to a particular year. It's not, for example, in the case of an Eved Ivri, you know, a Jew who sells himself for slavery, this is a condition came across that problem.
Yeah.
Then you might say that while in general the principle is that, you know, he works 6 years and the seventh year he's finished, right? this is independent of the Shvius business. In other words, his Shvius has nothing to do with the agricultural Shvius, okay? You understand what I'm saying? In other words, let's say that he sold himself in the year 3 of the cycle, the 7 year cycle, okay? So in that case, he would work for 6 years, and then when the seventh year comes, you know, then he doesn't work anymore, okay?
Oh.
But that, yeah.
He sold himself in the 3rd year?
Yeah. But he doesn't automatically go free in Shvius. He has to serve his 6 years, unless, of course, I mean, he's redeemed beforehand. Or he can redeem himself for something.
Course,
you know.
In
other
understand.
Words, if you pay back the debt that you owe,
yeah,
like that, then, you know, in that particular case, he's finished, you know. But there, he's independent. Whereas, with fields, all fields are subject to the year of Shvius, and that has nothing to do. In other words, if you buy, for example, a field in the 3rd year, and then you're only going to get the, you know, 4 years of, or 3 years of working and harvesting. So naturally, you would have to take it into account in the, let's say, if you hire, you know, or you rent or something like that. I mean, that would be one of the factors that you take into consideration. The same thing is true when days when they observe the Yovel, the Jubilee. So it's written over there specifically, Lefi Rov Hashonim, Lefi Ma'at Hashonim. In other words, according to how many, whether it's a lot of years before Yovel comes or whether it's a few years before. But this is going to affect, you know, what kind of terms you have at the time when you sign a contract, you know, for a field.
So what you're telling me then is that
all the farmers
would be unemployed during that period of time.
That is right, absolutely right. But as I say, today there is a legal fiction which came into being roughly around the 1880s or so. When, you know, Jews began to come, you know, modern Jews, so to speak, came to Israel and began to settle the land, and, you know, Shvius represented a very difficult time for them. So some of the great rabbis, like, for example, Rabbi Yitzchak Kochanan Spector, who was the Kovner Rav at that time, so he came up with a legal fiction whereby the land could be sold to a goy for the seventh year, and then, you know, the goy sells it back to the Jews. So technically then, if the land is the property of a goy at that particular time, then in that case you're allowed to work a field belonging to a goy.
Why do you call it legal fiction? I know
it's fiction because of the fact that
they construct an actual sale for the period of a year.
Right.
They what?
Find an Arab Muftar.
It's similar to selling chometz before Pesach. The same idea.
With the right to buy back at a certain time, and then they pay for.
Well, it's like somebody
But the difference is with chometz, you're not allowed to eat chometz even if you sell it, right?
Yeah.
But in the case of the shvius, if you sell that land for the Arab, you're still permitted to work it, you see.
Well, is that also the same like selling your business for the day of the Shabbos?
No, it's something
to
similar.
To a goy?
Correct. Yes.
You know, so this the whole thing would fall if the goy decides he owns it.
No, because you have the right to
this is right.
Back.
Today, today there are many Jews who refuse to abide by the sale of rights. And there's a difference between what the Rabbanut officially does in order to try to make it easier, based, as I said, upon the original decision of Rabbi Yitzchak Pochonim, as compared to the fact that many Jews don't want to abide by it. They feel that the law of the Torah says we got to rest, and so this is what they do. So that, for example, in all the colonies that are Aguda colonies, they don't work. And in those that are not Aguda, but you find many of them also that they observe Shviz. So they had to develop other things. First of all, what they developed was, for example, hydroponics, which has become, a big deal in Israel, where it's not actually in the soil. Right. They produce it, chemically, and so yeah, you're growing, but the prohibition is right
water.
Because it's written, Yishov Soho Oretz Shabbos LaShem, that the land is to observe a Sabbath unto the Lord. You understand?
So then you're saying on Shvius you're allowed to eat hydroponic vegetables?
Sure, absolutely. Of course. Colonies, that's why Petah Tikva is probably one of the first agricultural colonies, right, and they had some firm people over there, that's why it was a problem with them, right. Take a place like Mikveh Yisrael, which was also roughly about the same time, but they didn't have firm people, so they didn't ask any Shabbos.
We kind of got off the subject.
Yeah, there. Right. Yeah. Okay, but as you see, it comes from the text over here and so on. Okay, so... Yeah, Ela Tilo, he says, right, okay, so this is why I started to explain, that the laws of Shvius apply not just to the year of Shvius, but also to the period immediately before and after as well. Okay, Rabbi Yishmael here, Rabbi Yishmael says, Malch HaRish Rishus, Avkotzi Rishus, he says, just as, plowing is a voluntary act on the part of a person, so likewise, harvesting is also a voluntary act, but is there any time when it is a mitzvah to do it? So he says, yes. He says, Yotzo, there is an exception with what? Kitzir ha'omer, shehu mitzvah. The harvesting of the barley that had to be done on the second night of Pesach while the temple was in existence. It was a mitzvah for the Kohanim to go out into a field where barley was growing, and there they would cut the new barley of the year, and they would beat it and so on and so forth and make it into the size of an omer, that is the quantity of an omer, and then of course they would use it in order to make a mincha, in other words a grain offering to God, okay? And from that point on it meant that you could use the new produce. Prior to that, the Torah says, "Valechem akoli v'charmen lo soflu ad etzem hayom hazeh," that you are prohibited from eating any of the new grain, corn, etc., etc., that is grown until that particular time. So, until the second night of Pesach when they would do it, and then in the morning of the second day of Pesach, they would offer this up so that people could begin to enjoy the new grain. Yes, David. Yeah. The reaping was at night, but the actual, the bringing of the mincha, that would be the second day of Pesach, right? Which, of course, in Eretz Yisrael, if you realize, is actually it's Chol HaMoed as far as they're concerned.
Right.
But the point over here is this: that even if the second night of Pesach were to be on Shabbos, which in our calendar it never is anymore. But in those days when everything was according to the appearance of the moon, you know. That determined when Rosh Chodesh was, and therefore that would determine when Pesach was. So even if it were Shabbos, then in that case, the fact that the Torah commands that this has to be done, this would override the prohibition against Bechor Rishon of Chatzir. Okay? Omalei, Avul Da'avona and the Rava. So one of the rabbis, one Talmidim said to Rava, Mamai Decharishon Derishus, says, why are you assuming that we're talking about plowing, which is Rishus, which is only voluntary? Dilma Harishas Omer the Mitzvah. Maybe we're talking instead about the plowing of the to get the Omer of Bali, which is a Mitzvah. In this case, that the Torah would say that you must observe the Shabbos, not cut it. So we say no. It says Omalo. So he said to him, Kevan, the Im Motzo, Chorosh, Eino Chorosh, Love Mitzvah, right? So he says, if it was already plowed, right, if he found it plowed, then in that case he doesn't plow, and it's not a Mitzvah, so the answer is no, this is an exception. So it is a Mitzvah you have to do. Eisvei Ravina L'Rovo. So Ravina asked the following question of Rabbi. He says, Yotzo Ho'ofa Makes Benoi, right? Didn't we say that the father who strikes the son, the harav, harodes, talmido, or the teacher who chastises his student, who shlech bezdin, or the emissary of the bezdin, whose job it is to give malchus to the person, you know, who deserves it, amai, why? Leimo kevin the ilu gomir lav mitzvah. Why can't we say that if he had learned his lesson, then it's not a mitzvah to strike him, right? The Hashtaname love mitzvah, so here too, then we say it's not a mitzvah. So he says, Hosam Apal Gav de Gomir, there in the case of, let's say, the son or the student, right? Even if he had learned it, but nevertheless, Name mitzvah, there still is Name mitzvah Kovid, he is still performing a mitzvah, Dirsir, as is written, Yaseh bin Chum Yanichecho, right? Chastise your son. And he will give you rest, and as we said before, and he will also shep nachas subsequently in life from the fact that he's learned his lesson. So, wouldn't we say that the same thing would also apply over here? So, Hodram of the Rava, so that's when Rava said, Lab Milsahi Dami, says, you know, I didn't give such a good answer the first time, I have a different answer for you, right? Namely, Sira Dumya de Kharisha says, harvesting is similar to plowing. Ma Harisha, just as in the case of plowing, Motzah Chorosh, Eino Chorosh, that if he finds, already a field which has been plowed, so he doesn't plow. So Ab Kitzira Nami, likewise then, if he finds, an area which has already been reaped, he doesn't reap. So, in that case, V'yisalka Datech Mitzvah, and if you think that it's a mitzvah, motzo kotzur, eino kotzir, that if he finds what's already, reaped, does not have to be reaped. So nevertheless, we learn that that mitzvah diktzur lohavi, it still is a mitzvah to bring to reap and to bring.
Even if he found barley,
that's still wrong.
He was still wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. Whereas it's different from what we said before about the case of, let's say, the bringing of, of chopping the wood. Where would wood ever be, a mitzvah to chop?
Yeah, so
even if it's for the sukkah or for the yatzei marocha, it's not a mitzvah. Because if, let's say you were able to go to the market and you found beautiful wood that you wanted to give as a donation to the Beis HaMikdash for the yatzei marocha, you could do so. You don't have to go into the forest.
Right.
And
well,
the
here is
way,
the mandatory.
Right. Go to the lumber yard and you have already your lumber, in order to build the sukkah. You don't have to go out and do it. Okay, so we shall stop at this point and begin with the new Mishnah on Daf Ches Amud Beis next week in Yitzhak.
Right. Oh,
and again, we're very, very happy to welcome Sam back again in our midst. And we wish him a refuah shleima. Mechayel el chayel, which we usually translate from strength to strength.
November 1st, 1995. Right. It's November 8th, 1995, and
right.
We're on Daf
Ches Amud Beis, beginning with the Mishnah on that page.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Now, so since we studied this Mishnah, we're going to see that there's a contradiction to what we studied last week.
Okay.
All right. The Mishnah begins by saying, "Ha'av goel al yedei habein, v'habein goel al yedei ha'av." In other words, a father can go into exile if he happens to inadvertently kill his son, right? And the son also can go into exile if he inadvertently kills his father. And then the Mishnah continues, and it says, "Hakol golin al yedei Yisrael." In other words, anybody who happens to kill inadvertently a Jew goes into Golis. Yisrael goelin al yedehen, and a Jew goes into exile if he kills anybody except chutz neger toshav. If the person that he happened to kill is a ger toshav. Now, who is a ger toshav? So that, of course, needs definition. The word ger essentially has two different meanings. The original meaning of the word ger is somebody who's a stranger, and of course it comes from the word gor, which means to dwell someplace, right?
Doesn't ger also mean the convert?
All right, so I said it has two essential meanings as it's used in the Talmud, okay? You have what we call a ger tzedek, in other words, a person who converts to Yiddishkeit out of conviction, okay? And that's why we call him a ger tzedek, in other words, a righteous ger, because he accepted upon himself all the mitzvahs and the obligations that Judaism commands. And then we have a ger toshav. The ger toshav is a person who resides in Eretz Yisrael, but he does not give up his goyish citizenship. What he does instead is to be subject to Israeli law, and also he takes upon himself to actually fulfill the 7 mitzvahs b'nei Noach, that the goyim were originally commanded to observe, including the prohibition against idolatry. So in other words, he has to commit himself not to practice idolatry don't as well. But for example, he would be permitted, to the mixed milk and mixed flesh.
Would he still be considered a convert?
No, you might consider him maybe like a semi-convert, but he's certainly not a full
semicolon.
Yeah, he's not a convert in the true sense of the word.
So you can't.
But still, he has a certain privilege, and what would that privilege be? The privilege would be that he's permitted to live in Eretz Israel.
Okay.
I don't have to tell you that according to Meir Kahana, Zichroino Livrocha, the Arabs would be more or less in the same category as Ger Toshav. Because he said, by the way, he was greatly misunderstood as to what he said. You read all the press, the media, and they all say he wanted to expel all the Arabs from Eretz Israel. He didn't exactly say that. He had several ideas concerning the Arabs. One idea that he had concerning the Arabs is, that there should be, let's say, Jews were expelled from Arab lands, right? So he would be happy to compensate Arabs and as long as they gain to one of the other Arab lands, there were plenty of them, and he would have paid them for that in order to do it. He wasn't trying to expropriate their land or their homes or whatever it may be without compensation. But he felt, that Arabs in the midst of Israel, they create problems.
Suppose they didn't want to go.
All right, and we see, that was the problem. He wanted to make it attractive to them. Okay. But the other thing, he said, look, if they want to be like a ger toshav, in other words, to undertake that they would be, they would live in accordance with Israeli law, and, that they would not do any harm, that they would be loyal to the state of Israel, then in that case he was willing to let them stay over there. But he was afraid, that they would be demanding their independence and work, even within Israel, against the interests of Israel. This is what he was afraid of. So, you know, some of his ideas actually have found expression among, you know, some of the people today. Even though, not only that he was assassinated, but if you remember, prior to that, the Israeli government threw out his party from the Knesset, even though they had won legitimate seats in the parliament. But all the other parties ganged up on Meir Kahana, because he was too much of a troublemaker as far as they were concerned. So, at any rate, getting back to the idea about the Ger Toshav, the Ger Toshav is a person who is not a Jew, but he undertakes to observe Jewish law to the extent, you know, that he will engage, he will not engage in idolatry, that, you know, he forswears such other things that were prohibited in the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, which include, for example, that you agree to abide by law.
Law of the land.
Law of the land, right. And, but by law, in a sense, you know, if you have disputes and so on, you go to a court and you're willing to abide by decisions of a court. And then, of course, another of the prohibitions is that what we call Eiver Min HaChai. In other words, you're not allowed to tear a limb from a living animal and eat it. This was prohibited to B'nai Noach, you know, right after the flood, when they were finally given permission to eat meat. If you remember, originally, until that time, they were supposed to eat only, you know, fruits, vegetables, and so on. But afterwards, the B'nai Noach were given permission to eat meat, but it says, you know, several things. Right? That they're not allowed, excuse me, to eat the blood of an animal. And this is interpreted to mean, you know, they're not allowed to tear a limb off a living animal. And then, of course, they have to promise that they're not going to commit murder and so on. In other words, Shfichas Domim is prohibited. Gilui Arois, in other words, to practice immorality. This is also prohibited. So these are the conditions that the Ger Toshav has to abide by. Nevertheless, we see that since they were never fully Jewish, in the sense that they didn't go the final step and seek complete conversion to Yiddishkeit, so that therefore their status is such that they are partly Jewish, so to speak, subject to Jewish law, but at the same time, they are still not exactly on the same level with a Jew. A ger, for example, a ger tzedek is permitted to marry a Jew, with the exception
of a kohen.
Right, as we learned, you know, a woman who is a convert to Yiddishkeit cannot marry a kohen. But by the same token, so she can't marry. But if a woman is divorced, so it's also Torah has prohibited that.
A ger, a male ger, marry a kohen's daughter?
Yes.
Could you?
Yes. Of course, the prohibition does not apply to the female descendants of God, only to the males. Mm-hmm. Right. So these were some of the problems, you see, that they have. All right. So getting back to the Mishnah then. So it says that Habein Gol Al Yedeh, right. Israel Gol Al Yedehin, right, that any Jew who commits inadvertently manslaughter would go into Golas Chutz Meger Toshav, unless, except for the fact if he happened to kill inadvertently a Ger Toshav. And the Ger Toshav Eino Gola, he does not go into exile El Al Yedeh Ger Toshav, except if he happens to kill inadvertently another Ger Toshav, then he's also permitted to go into Golas.
He gets two for the price of one, is that what he's saying?
No, he's not saying that. But what he's saying is, you know, that in that particular case, and then he would be subject to the same law, or if you want, to the same privilege, if you feel it that way, that, you know, he could go into Golas. And remember, as we've already spoken week after week,
inadvertently kills a Ger Toshav.
Right. But if a Jew kills him, then in that case, he does not go into Golas. Okay?
But if a Ger Toshav kills one, another Ger, he goes into Egypt.
That's
to
correct.
That's what you're
right,
to say.
Right. But if a Ger Toshav kills an Israelite, then in that particular, you know, somebody is 100% Jewish, and in that case, he does not go into exile, but instead he has a more severe punishment, obviously.
Face the consequences.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what's going to happen, this is going to be discussed in the Gemara. Okay. So now the Gemara continues. And I notice that, first of all, there's a contradiction here with what we had just a few lines up above on the same page. It says, Ha'ov goyla al yedei habein, right? The father goes into exile if he inadvertently kills his son. So they say, Amrit, didn't you say just above that Yotzo of Hamakes Beno the Gomir, right? In other words, the father, well, alright, I have to put a period after the word Hamakes Beno, alright? Didn't you say that the father who struck his son, in other words, I mean, he struck him and killed him, you know, as a result of that, he does not go into exile. Why? Because, as we learned a few lines above, we said that it is a mitzvah for a father to chastise his son, right, to punish him, to chastise him, in order to teach him, you know, how to behave. So they ask the question, they say to Gomir, you say that maybe the son is learned. Didn't you say just before that the Afal Gav de Gomir, that even though the son is learned and he knows, you know, the difference between right and wrong, nevertheless, didn't we say mitzvah kovid, that you know, the father is performing a mitzvah if he strikes the son in order to keep him on the straight and narrow path? So therefore, it's a contradiction. So how do we resolve the contradiction? So he says, we're talking about a different case over here, that we were saying, you know, that of Gelal Yedei HaBein, it doesn't mean in the case that we said before, namely that, you know, where he wants to shmeis him because he feels he has to teach him a lesson and you know, make sure, you know, that he will study Torah, or that he will behave and so on and so forth. But we're talking instead b'shul yedadak, we're talking about where the father insist that the son be apprenticed to a carpenter. So they say, Shulya Dinagra, Kiyusahi, Delamde, right? What do you mean? And if he's apprenticed to a carpenter, the son is going to depend upon this for a livelihood, and therefore, the father has the right, you know, to chastise the son and make him learn carpentry so that the son will in turn be able to make a living. Okay?
Yeah.
Right. Because the Gemara in Kedushin that we studied several years ago speaks, if you remember, about what are some of the obligations that the father has towards his son. You know, mitzvah sa'ov al habein, if you remember. For example, he's commanded, of course, you know, to see to it that he learns Torah, right? He's also commanded that he has to teach him an umanus or malacha. In other words, he has to teach him
trade
or craft or something like that. Why? Because we want to make sure that when the son grows up, he's not going to be malastim and sabrius. He's not going to rob other people in order to make his living. He has to learn a practical trade so that he can make a living for himself. But if you remember, one of the other mitzvahs was the fact that at least according to one opinion, that the father is obligated to teach his son how to swim so that in case he can survive. I mean, if like this, you know, if he gets into a river or a lake or something like that, you know, that he has to cross, then he'll know to save his own life. So that was also one of the mitzvahs. Alright, so in other words, teaching him a trade is then an obligation of the father. We should say that the father wants to chastise his son in order to make sure that he's going to learn a trade, then this is part of his obligation, right? So why should he go into Golis, as the Mishnah says, of Gedal Yudei HaBein over here? So they give an explanation. The explanation is the Gomir Umanus Achrite. We're talking where the father insists that he should learn a different trade, whereas the son already has a trade or a handicraft that you know, he'll be able to make a living. So since the father was chastising him for nothing, since the son already had a parnasa under his belt, so in that particular case If he killed him inadvertently by striking him, then in that particular case he would have to go into Golos. So what we learned previously would not apply in this particular case.
But without the intent, he struck him without the intent to kill him.
Oh yeah, right. He didn't intend to kill him in any case, obviously. I mean, look, murder is murder. If he happened to, do it deliberately, then in that particular case, he would be subject to the same death penalty as anybody else who murders deliberately. And how about the next part of the Mishnah? Habein Golad Yedehov, that the son goes into exile if he strikes his father. So Veraminhu. So they ask Akasha about this. They say, look, there's a contradiction over here. Torah says, Barkein Nefesh, one who strikes a soul, in other words, he strikes a person, he kills a person. And of course, we're talking again still about inadvertently, we're not talking about deliberately. So he says, Prot, this would exclude what? Lamake Oviv, the person who strikes his father. Because in this particular case, we would say that this is, a little different. Okay. Let's take a look at the Rashi up to this point, okay? Starting from where the Gemara is. Mm-hmm. All right, you see the Rashi over there. Mm-hmm. All right, the first thing that Rashi discusses is Bishulya Denagre. So he explains that the Denagre is Belimud Charash Heitzim. In other words, the trade of being able, to cut wood, or carpentry, as we would say, right? To be a craftsman with wood. She'enu malam de Torah, elu modus. He's not teaching him now Torah, which we said before, but he's teaching him a trade, right? And shulya, so he says, this is an old French word, which means an apprentice, okay? Obviously, it has to mean that. But I haven't figured out what the French is over there. Chouandre or something like that it is. Okay. Alright. So they say, but look, if he's learning carpentry, then chiyusihu, right? The abzu mitzvah of the labdo. This is also a mitzvah for the father to teach his son a trade, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Yalpin and Lomi Kroos, we learn, from Sukkim, the Perakam of the Kedush, the first chapter of the Kedush, the Siv. As it says in Scripture, Re'ei Chaim im Isha Shehavto, that you should see life, literally, in other words, enjoy life with the woman whom you love. This is we find that in Ecclesiastes, in Kohelet, it's a passage mm-hmm. over there. So, Hikish Umonus Shehu Chiyusa Li'isha. So, the Gemara, there in Kedushin, makes a comparison between a trade, which is to be his source of living, to a wife. Because a wife is also, she's a source of life mm-hmm. to a husband, right? So, Kishem She'oviv Chayiv Lahatsiyoi Isho, or as Gemara says a little differently, it says that even just as his father has an obligation to marry him off to a woman, in other words, this is also one of the mitzvahs, the father has to find a shidduch for his son, right? Kiddich Siv. As it is written, Kul of Nechem Doshim, that you should take for your sons' wives. So Kach Chayv Lelam Diyamonis. So likewise, then he is obligated to teach him a trade. So then, what did we say? We say Maki Nefesh. Remember, we said that the pasuk, which says that, pardon me.
You want to rest?
No, that's all right. But it says Maki Nefesh. And we say that if a person, kills another human being inadvertently, of course, but this and he's therefore sent into exile, right? Mm-hmm. So prot, this excludes the Maki Ovi, right? So now, what is Maki Nefesh? So Rashi is telling us that it's Gabe Horeg Bishgogaksiv. This is in reference to somebody who kills inadvertently. And it's written over there, Lonus Shoma, that he is to flee over there, right? Lonus Shoma Maki Nefesh Mishkoga, that this is where a person who slays another inadvertently is to flee over there. So Protus excludes the Maki Oviv, right? One who slays his father. Shelo Chayev Golos, that he does not go into galus. Elo lemi shakosoy teluyo b'nefesh she'enu chayav olov elim ken harogol. But rather, it refers to kill some soul, he says, where there is, that is, the soul is the soul of somebody else upon whom the son is not dependent. This is how Rashi explains it. Okay? Elam ken harogo, if he kills him. So yotza maki obiv, shehu chayav olov misa. This would exclude somebody who slays his father inadvertently, who deserves, as a result of it, the death penalty. You understand? Because in the Torah, there is a special prohibition. Parsha Mishpatim says, Make ove v'yimo, mos yumas. Okay? That if somebody slays his father or his mother, then he shall surely be put to death.
But it doesn't make any provision.
But make actually doesn't mean slay. Make means what?
Strike.
Okay. So therefore, the Gemara comes along and says that what do we mean by hakor? We say that by hakor, this is somebody who strikes his father or his mother, and he forms a chabura. In other words, what he does is that he injures him, so that there is, you know, a definite welt or something like that that you can see, you know, that he struck him, you see. It causes physical injury to him. It's not a love tap, but it actually causes physical injury. So that's what the Torah is talking about when it says, most humans, that he deserves the death penalty. Okay?
In other words, it was intentional.
Right. The chabura be'alma. In other words, by, you know, striking him and causing a, you know, a... a wound, right, and wounding him, any kind of a wound, because alto datech v'mayet leim golus, right, and therefore we say that this pasuk would now exclude him from going into golus apila harogo, even if he killed him, because as long as we have already now two prohibitions, okay, we'll see that now we have a different problem, and that problem is that if a person is subject to two different penalties simultaneously, then we have a statement in the Talmud that says kimle b'derabo mine, which means that he is given the penalty, the more severe of the penalties. Alright, so in other words, inadvertently, had he killed him, then what? Then he would get golus, right? But inasmuch as he struck him, so that already would be subject to the other one, which would say, you know, that maki yovi yimo mos yumos. So that's the penalty that he should get. And if he gets mos yumos, then he should not go into golus. And yet, of course, what did the Mishnah say? The Mishnah says, v'habein goel al yidei hov, right? That the son does go into golus if he inadvertently kills his father. So in that case, we see again that, you know, there is a contradiction between these two. Is it possible to straighten out the contradiction between these two statements? So Omar Rav Kana said, Lekasha, he says, it's not a difficulty. Why? Because Hor Rab Shimon and Hor Rabban. What we have over here are two different ideas. We have, first of all, a statement by Rabbi Shimon, who says that, you know, the Makeh Oviv deserves the death penalty because he struck his father, right? And on the other hand, we have the Rabbonim who say in the Mishnah that, the Habein Gole Al Yedei Ha'av, that the son can get Golis if he, kills inadvertently his father. So there's a difference of opinion between Rabbi Shimon and the Rabbonim. The Rabbi Shimon, in accordance with Rabbi Shimon's opinion, what is it based on? The Omar, he says, Chedek Chomur Misayef. And Shigegas Sayef Nitel Chaporo, but Shigegas Chedek Lo Nitel Chaporo. Okay, let's analyze this line and a half right now. You are familiar, of course, that on Yom Kippur, you know, we have the confession of sins, right? And towards the end of the Shmon Esra, you know, after all the Al-Khaits, so we say, V'al Chatoim Shonachayim Chatos, Oilo, Goyla, Golos, etc., etc., you know. And then we say, and for those sins for which we deserve, Arba Misas Bezdin, the four forms of execution that the court could inflict, namely what?
Malchus.
That's not execution.
Oh, excuse me.
Execution, all right. You have...
Stoning.
Yeah, you have Skila, Sreifa, Herig, Vechenik, okay? All right, now Skila is, of course, stoning, right? And then Sreifa. Sreifa means that they force hot lead into the mouth of the person, so the person dies as a result of ingesting the hot lead, okay? Herig means that they are killed by the sword, which in those days, as Gemara in Sanhedrin explains, that they used the they followed the Roman model, which was, you know, to strike off the head of the person.
Right.
Beheading, okay? And then finally, chenek is strangling, where, you know, they would get... Not hanging.
Carrying.
No. Two guys, one guy would hold them, you know, they put like a scarf around, actually it says two scarfs, one soft around the neck so that, you know, he shouldn't feel pain. Because even in execution, you still have to have respect for the fact that he's a human being made in the image of God.
Right. You're not going to feel pain.
And then, you know, the outer cloth that they use for strangulation, this already was a hotter one, you know, that they could pull tight, and, you know, the two witnesses. See, this would be, you know, that the witnesses themselves who testify against this person that he deserves the death penalty, they are the ones who have to, they have to perform the execution itself. So, you know, one
never,
holds this way, the other one, and then, is it ever done?
Was it ever done?
We have to presume that maybe at one time or other it was done, okay? But of course, as we learned a few topping back over there, we saw that what constitutes a murderous Sanhedrin. You remember that one?
Yeah.
Right at the end of the previous chapter.
Right.
Once in 7 years, once in 70 years, if you remember, right? And, you know, and then finally along came Rabbi Tavda and Rabbi Akiva, and they said, if we were in the Sanhedrin, nobody would ever get the death penalty. And they say, how come? So because they say, because we would ask the questions of the witnesses, you know, so much, we would be so tough in our asking the witnesses, you know, this about the various details, that the witnesses themselves would probably become confused and not be able to give the kind of testimony. Right, which would be necessary in order to convict a person and administer the death penalty. So, I have no doubt that at one time or other, death penalty was probably invoked. But, as we see, by the time that we reach the time of Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Akiva, in other words, close to 2,000 years ago, 1,900 years ago, let's say, all right? At that point, they already were no longer executing people. Not only that, but of course, we learned also, Gemara and Sanhedrin and other places too, that 40 years prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, in other words, roughly around, let's say, around the year 30 or so of the Common Era, right? The Sanhedrin itself no longer sat in the Lishkas HaGozis, and therefore they were no longer permitted to assess the death penalty.
Essentially,
you would take the position then from that point on, modern Judaism doesn't side with capital punishment.
Yeah. But of course, on the other hand, if you remember, there was one critique. Let's look back a couple of pages to the end of Zion over there. There it says over there, right? Well, it's in the Mishnah before. Okay. Yeah. The Mishnah on the top of the page over there. Remember, it says, you know, that Sanhedrin Ahiregis Echad Yeshavu, in other words, once in 7 years, Zion Aleph, yeah. Nikrit Chavlan is right that they were destructive. Rabbi Yehuda Ezra Nazari Omer Echad Leshivim Shana, right? If it convicted a person to death even once in 70 years. Rabbi Tafa, Rabbi Akiva, and Ilo Yidin Sanhedrin, they like Odom Yoilam, no one would ever be. But what was the reaction of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel over there? He says, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, Ap Hain Marbin Shoch Hedom B'Yisrael. With an attitude such as theirs, so it would have increased murders among the Jewish people. In other words, you know,
they'll
people
get away with it.
Exactly, they'll get away with it. So, not to an increase.
You can assume from that, therefore, that the capital punishment is a deterrent of the world.
Right, absolutely. But, you know, we Jews don't enforce it. So.
Except for the Nazi and Nazi collaborators.
Yeah, Israel today, right. They're the only ones who, you know, and how many has that happened? It only happened in the case of Eichmann. So.
Are they trying to give him
a
death penalty?
No, they'll give him a life
in prison.
Yeah. Of course, they'll butcher him to death, but that's a different story, you know.
Well,
obviously,
they'll run
you don't
him
know
off.
To right to butcher to death. They'll torture him. They'll make life miserable for him. Okay, but nevertheless, the court can only sentence him to life in prison.
They announced that even over TV.
Well, life in prison doesn't necessarily mean he'll stay in prison all his life.
Right. I mean, undoubtedly without any parole or something like
really?
That. I would think so. I mean, you know, because usually, you know, most people who are sentenced to life imprisonment after a certain number of years, you know, they already say, oh, okay, they served a long time in prison, and Shein Genug, and so on. We need room for a few more people over there, mm-hmm. so, you know, they send them out. But in certain cases, a person who has been sentenced to life imprisonment cannot be pardoned. He simply has to spend the rest
American
of his life,
says,
I would think so.
The procedure right now is he plead insanity.
Yeah.
And they probably have to give him a psychiatric.
But if he were in the United States.
I'm sure that they would.
If he were in the United States.
If you listen.
But even in Israel, I mean, it is possible to have a psychiatric examination and then, you know, to say that the person was out of his mind.
Yeah, but if you listen to the television, all the elements that the police investigation has gone through is to show point by point premeditation.
Yes.
For example, they had him
admit that he acted
in premeditation, and he prepared the weapon,
right?
And he prepared the bullets, and he said that he knew what he was doing when he did it.
He would do it again,
right?
And he had the intent to come. I mean, it's like out of the statute. He knew what they were doing.
Right. He made two previous attempts. I understand.
Yeah.
To do that.
That's what they said.
Nope.
All right, let's get back to our text. I explained, you know, that there are four methods of execution, right? Okay. Now, the question is, which is considered the more severe form? Okay?
Anyway, you get it, it's dead.
Which is considered the more severe form?
I don't know.
Right?
Beheading?
Skilo, Srepa, Herig, Vechenik. Okay, so there's a difference of opinion, right, between... Herig?
Herig
has been that he put him to death by using the sword.
Don't you mention those after the Sanatokiv? Aren't they mentioned there?
No, I said it's at the end of the Yom Kippur davening. We always say it. After all the Al Chaits.
Oh, yeah.
That's where we find the expression.
Yes,
okay? So there's a difference of opinion. According to some, Skilas Chamur. Okay? In other words, the most severe penalty is stoning. Based on what? So the answer is because it's based on certain psukim in the Torah where this is prescribed as the death penalty. In other words, one of them would be, let's say, for the violation of Shabbos. Okay? Where if you violate Shabbos, you know, publicly and contemptuously, and you're warned that this is a violation of Shabbos, and you say, I don't give a damn, and even though I know I'm going to be put to death for it, I don't care, I'll still go ahead and do it, and so, you know, which is what the whole business of what we call hasra, you know, the warning that has to be given by the witnesses to the person, you know, to warn him that he's liable to the death penalty, and he says, I don't give a damn, I'm going to go ahead, even though I know I'm going to get it, and so, okay. So skila is mentioned as far as Shabbos is concerned, and then there are also certain types of adultery too that are punishable by that. Okay? So, since the violation of Shabbos is considered a very serious violation, so that therefore there are those who say that skila is the most severe, and then in the descending order in which we mention it, so that chenik, in other words strangulation, is considered the easiest of the penalties. No, Rabbi Shimon reverses it. He says that chenik is more severe, and you go up the scale. Okay? In other words, that skila would be the lightest penalty in his opinion. All right, listen, he's a great rabbi, he's entitled to his opinion, but nevertheless, it's not the majority opinion. But still,
well, really, what does
this
it
is
matter?
What we have. Yeah.
Why does it matter?
Yeah, why? But it's like, if you take shkita, is that the word? If you kill an animal, and Judaism approaches the animal, whether you're going to kill it, but you're going to kill it...
you have to do it humanely, right?
Humanely.
And there are all kinds of rules, right, that you have to examine your chalav. You know, the knife has to be examined to make sure that there isn't any imperfection. And then there are certain laws that we say are halacha l'moshe l'misinai. In other words, this goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. It's an oral tradition going right back again. And they include such things as, for example, where do you have to make the cut? Can only be in the neck area, okay? And you have to sever... not the otter, it's the windpipe and the esophagus. It has to be severed in the case of an animal. In the case of a chicken, you'd have to sever one of them, okay? But the idea there, of course, is, you know, is to take where it's going to cause most of the blood to spread forth, you know, because after all we're not allowed to eat blood, so this is one way to get rid of a great deal of the blood. The rest of it has to be done through the kashering process, okay?
Are you...
I just want to say, if, let's say, you started and you wind up outside the area, hagroma, that's also prohibited. Or you take the end and you just pierce, this is also prohibited. It has to be, you know, with a smooth stroke, okay? So,
you're
not allowed to tear.
I can't tear.
No. You tear, you're making the animal trafe.
Piercing and tearing the same thing?
No, because you have to use a knife. Okay? You must use a sharp knife, right? It's the only way you can perform shit. You can't perform shit in any other way. So all these, you know, as I say, these are rules that they have to observe, okay? Now, you're right. I mean, the animal is going to be dead in any way. But still, there's only one way in which it conforms to the laws of Shechita, so that we as Jews are permitted to eat that animal.
I think
that
there was recently a protest group that when the United States government was going to come up with rules on USDA
right.
and how the killing was handled. There were protest groups against the Judaism, the Jewish approach, and yet that came out.
Yeah.
It was the best.
This has been a tremendous problem that Jews have had to face for several hundred years.